Okay, so we begin our first full day of practice, and trying to think what's a useful way to begin. In terms of our practice, they one of the foundations that are necessary for meditation, for cultivation of the Buddha's path, is mindfulness. It's on a certain level, a distinguishing characteristic of the Buddha's teaching. When he gives instruction on the cultivation of the path, and gives a kind of an assurance of, say, a realization of the goal. It's in relationship to if one were to bring into being and maintain mindfulness or right mindfulness for, I mean, starts off with 7 years, but it goes down to 7 days. If we could just do it for 7 days. We've got 10, so. You know, we've got a bit of leeway there, so. But if we're able to do it for 7 days, then one would at least realize entering the stream of Dhamma, the first stage of awakening. So that's a bold statement, and it's also, I think, a very important way to relate to the practice, that there is, it isn't so much, what piece of information did you get from the Buddha that's going to change your heart, free the mind, or what you believe in strongly, but how you cultivate this quality of mindfulness. And it's mindfulness is a bit of a popular topic these days. I mean, it's getting a lot of popular press. There's all sorts of, there's even going to be a conference on mindfulness next year, which I was invited to and then turned down to go. And then Ajahn Amaro came to visit, and he's one of the organizers. Whoops. So, that's a bit of rejig in there. That's next year, June, San Francisco State University. Yeah, and Ajahn Amaro was saying that, I can't remember the years now, but maybe 15 years ago, there was something like worldwide, something like 400 academic papers on mindfulness, and last year or the year before, it was something like 7,000. So, yeah, these are academic papers on a sort of a university graduate level. So there's an increased interest, mainstream, in mindfulness. That's another thing that Ajahn Amaro was telling us, that there's a standing committee in the British Parliament on mindfulness. And then Ajahn Kurundamo's question was, don't they have sitting or walking committees? It's members of the House of Commons, members of the House of Lords, other luminaries. Well, that's pretty mainstream. I can't imagine anything like that in our legislative branches. It's like, what is the you know, what's the antonym for progress? It's Congress. So that there's on a governmental level, and actually Ajahn Amaro was saying they had a meeting they had in the late summer, early fall. The actual topic of discussion was the concern that mindfulness was being taken out of its Buddhist roots and applied in ways that were, say, not kind of encouraged or sanctioned by Buddhism, which is very interesting that on an official level that there's a recognition that Buddhism actually does have very clear guidelines and standards, and it isn't your kind of whatever makes you feel good is Buddhism. So that mindfulness being a quality that we cultivate and develop and apply appropriately to the goal of the Buddhist teachings, so that in our practice it's important to have a fundamental understanding of what we mean by mindfulness, because it there is a lot of buzzwords around and a lot of interpretations of mindfulness in the sense of either a, because sometimes it's to be mindful is you've got to have this one-pointed focused attention that's unwavering, and then that's mindfulness, except you're tend to be giving yourself ulcers and tying yourself up in knots, or kind of a choiceless awareness, which is sort of spacious and fundamentally meaningless. So that's just kind of nebulous awareness of something, I don't know. But that's, it's really important to come back to, how does the Buddha himself define his terms? How does he encourage that application? And that when one goes back to the scriptures and to the discourses, there's a stock phrases when the Buddha speaks of mindfulness that he uses over and over and over again. And mindfulness it has a constellation of functions or characteristics, maybe. The Pali it's helpful to actually, if we plant seeds of scriptural language, Pali language, I think it's helpful sometimes to know, because English, we're doing rough approximations with English, and it's helpful to know some of the terminology, because it doesn't mean exactly the same thing, say, in the language that we're familiar with. So that the atapi sampajano satima, so the first three, and then the last is a phrase, vinaya lokeya bichato manasa. And atapi is in reference to effort. Ajahn Jeff translates it as ardent. I think that's a very good way of translating it. When it's translated into the Thai language, they don't even bother to try to find a word. It's a whole phrase that describes it. It's having the effort which helps to burn up defilements. So that it's this is not a passive, unengaged quality. One is engaging in the application of mindfulness. So that sense of bringing up effort, and it's also important to always remember that when the Buddha speaks of effort, say, like right effort in the Noble Eightfold Path, it's not defined by the degree of spectacular flailing around that we do. It's defined by the quality of the heart, so that the effort that we put in, which allows the heart to relinquish what is unskillful, what's unwholesome, and allows the wholesome and skillful qualities of the heart to shine forth. That's what effort is. It's, say, our right effort is characterized by the quality of heart that is applied to it. So that there is, yes, there is this ardent quality, there is this kind of putting forth of energy, but it's not tense, it's not tight. It's serving a purpose. The next atapi sambhajana. Sambhajana is translated as clear comprehension, usually. I think Ajahn Jeff translates it as aware.
Alert.
Yeah, alertness. So that there's this quality of being alert. But I think that quality of clear comprehension is, there is an alertness, but it also is kind of serving a function. And traditionally, the clear comprehension is defined or characterized in four ways. And one is the clear comprehension of purpose, so that there is what we're mindful of. You know, what are we trying to do? What is our goal? What are we doing? What are we trying? What are we attempting here? And what's its function? Is it going to be wholesome? Is it going to be beneficial? So there's a purpose there that one can discern, can see. One's alert to that, and that's it's essential to be able to. To recognize that in the sense of, you know, our mind swings. It swings from a nebulous drifting to overly obsessive, and it's that swinging, of course, that keeps us off kilter, out of balance. And so that clear comprehension is such an important quality to be training oneself in, and reminding oneself, okay, what is the purpose? What am I up to? What's it for? Will this work? And that's where it sort of comes into, say, suitability as well. Clear comprehension of suitability. And this is, of course, whether it's in terms of our actual formal meditation practice or in our day-to-day life. This clear comprehension is an important faculty to be attending to. And that suitability is this, what I'm doing, what meditation I'm doing, or how I'm applying this meditation object, is it suitable for my temperament? Is it suitable for this particular time? Is it suitable for the energy that I've got right now? Is it suitable for my health right now? There's all these different factors that we need to be attending to and alert to. This is a good use of the way that how Ajahn Jeff defines it as alertness. Are we alert to the suitability of what we're doing, how we're doing it? So that clear comprehension of suitability. Clear comprehension of, it's translated as domain. And so that can be like the circumstances that we're in. Just because we've got a good, maybe we've all come across this, just because we've got a good idea or we think we've got a good idea doesn't necessarily mean everybody else is going to agree with us or that it's going to be suitable for the circumstances that we decide to inflict other people with. So that a clear comprehension of domain, and that means the environment, the circumstances that we're in. It's like if you're, if something is time sensitive, like a particular task, or helping out with the setup in the morning, say, or whatever your chore is, getting the breakfast going, and no one decides to keep one's Mahasi Sayadaw technique going everybody else is trying to set up the breakfast for them, and you're still walking down the hall, and sort of you're getting to be close to 7:30. So that at suitability of domain, the circumstances, the environment. The last one is the suitability of non-delusion, suitability of reality, of truth. So that we're able to maintain a clear comprehension of that, those perceptions of truth. This is the way things are. That's that where we have, we're able to take into account, in our application of mindfulness and cultivation of mindfulness, we're able to take into account the reality of uncertainty, of impermanence, where we're able to take into account the reality of, oh, this is the way things are. Or the reality of non-self. We can incorporate that, and not in an idealized way, but in a way that has an ease and humility that naturally manifests, because there's clear comprehension, there's alertness to the reality, the truth of things. So that application of clear comprehension as a function of our practice and training. So ardent, alert, the third quality, sattima, possessed of mindfulness, possessed of awareness, having this quality of mindfulness. The word sati, that is usually translates into mindfulness, it's helpful to recollect that its root in terms of a word is the same as, like, when we do the morning chanting, sanya, anicca, perception is impermanent, sanya, anatta, perception is not self. It's the same root. So that characteristic of perception is the quality of memory. We are able to perceive things because we have a memory of it. And also in memory, perception, being able to give meaning and value to things is organized through our ability to remember. So that the quality of, of sati, of mindfulness, the word recollection is a good, somewhat literal translation, because it reflects that quality of memory and function of memory. Again, that sense of mindfulness is not an isolated phenomena that doesn't take into account our past experience, doesn't take into account our ability to recollect and remember what we did, what worked, what didn't work, how to integrate. Of course, these qualities are working together, that sense of ardent, alert, mindful. These are not discrete, separate qualities, but they're a constellation of qualities of the heart, of the mind, as it's attentive, as it's present. The last quality is, in the Pali, vinaya loke abhichato manasa. Subduing greed and distress toward the world. The literal meaning of, say, a Vinaya is to lead out, to lead away. So that, say, like the monk's discipline is called the Vinaya. And it sort of leads us away from the world to Dhamma. It's a tool. So that's, say, a function of, say, of sila or of precepts and training. And that sense of mindfulness of leading out from the, in the Pali, apicca tomanasa, is greed and distress, liking, disliking, and the moods that the mind, again, the swinging pendulum of our reactions to the contact with the world. And we say world, I mean, when the Buddha's asked what the world is, the world is sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, mental objects. And it's a, it's not the buildings and people and trees and whatnot. It's, those are part of the, it's like the sphere of our sensory input. So that it is bringing the world back into our experience and not objectifying or externalizing it too much. You know, one obviously has to live in the world and engage with the world skillfully, but it's important to remember that one has an anchor in one's ability to know and to take responsibility, which of course is what mindfulness is. Being mindful is to learn how to really take responsibility for ourselves in the world, our relationship to the world. So this ability to observe and be alert and to restrain that tendency, either to leap up with something that's exciting and interesting and fascinating, or get irritated or feel oppressed by something that is unpleasant, that is unwanted. And that quality of mindfulness is what helps us to weave our way through those habits and to have an anchor of stability and clarity. So that's a faculty that we cultivate, we develop, we rely on in our practice. And so as we... especially as we're thinking in terms of beginning a retreat, to place that quality of mindfulness front and center, whether it's sitting meditation, walking meditation, whether it's chanting, whether it's going in and out of the hall, whether it's helping out with chores, whether it's eating, whether everything is a basis for the establishing of mindfulness. And of course, the Buddha lays out that broad sphere of the realm of what we need to be attentive to in his discourse on the foundations of mindfulness. And as we bring that to mind in our applying of attention, in our meditation, in our, especially if we're thinking in terms of sitting, paying attention to posture, paying attention to the breath, paying attention to the thoughts and feelings that come up. Are we actually mindful? Are we ardent, alert, aware? As opposed to, say, reactive or dull or drifting or restless. And those are all objects that we can be attentive to. It doesn't mean that just because we've got the good idea to be mindful, that our minds actually comply. Training is such a key word in the Buddha's approach. That this is something that we can be doing. We can train our hearts, we can train our minds, And the Buddha sort of says, you know, whatever thought or mood we attend to, it gives it strength and power. That's the nature of the mind. So if we're, you know, we get obsessed with some particular thing, either our own feeling of discomfort, or which doesn't mean it's not real, but the more we give attention to it, the more it gains momentum in the mind. Or similarly, paying attention to thoughts of loving kindness. The more we give attention to it, it gains momentum, it gains traction in the mind. So that being mindful of what we're doing, rather than being a kind of like a passive bystander to our own minds. The Buddha is saying we can train this mind. As intractable as it is sometimes, as difficult as it feels sometimes, we can still train it. And that's a real gift, that we have these teachings. The Buddha gives an image for mindfulness as being the relating it to in his time and his actual experience, being a prince from the warrior caste, and compares it to the gatekeeper of a frontier fortress, a wise, intelligent gatekeeper. Our mindfulness is applying itself, as the gatekeeper, to seeing, okay, who comes in, who stays out, who stays outside of the fortress, who do you let in, and when that discernment and intelligence is exercised, then your inner gatekeeper is doing the duty of attending to, okay, what do we want to attend to? What do we want to let in here? What do we want to associate with? And it's similar to, I'm thinking of what comes to mind is the word that Ajahn Mun used in terms of developing the practice, but sort of cultivating an inner witness, so that we have an inner witness that is able to sort of have that same quality of being a gatekeeper, having that inner witness that's able to be clear, be discerning, and to learn how to look after ourselves. The quality of mindfulness and attentiveness, it's serving a function as well in that sense. Like it's like when the image that Ajahn Chah gives of a meditator being like a spider sits in its web and sits in the center of its web. Some bug comes by, has contact with the spider web. Spider goes out, catches it, wraps it up, uses it for its food. And in the same way, as a practitioner, we stay in our, we have our center. Our center is our mindfulness. Our center, our anchor, our base. Our center of our web is our mindfulness, our clear comprehension, our ardency, our willing to be with awareness, to have that inner witness. And then as we experience things, moods of the mind, mindfulness has the function of attending to it, bringing it back into the heart, and yeah, digesting it for food. And of course the food of the things that nourish us, nourish our wisdom, turning sense contact into discernment and understanding. It doesn't matter what we contact. It doesn't matter what kind of mood it is. It's our inner clarity that sees it, discerns it, understands it, has its context. It doesn't get caught up in the reactions and then relinquishes it, releases it. It's a nutriment for our practice. It's not an impediment. As oftentimes we feel that when there's something that, something annoying or something that feels really compelling. But it's that quality of mindfulness in conjunction with discernment that takes that and doesn't get swept up in the reactions, takes it in, uses it as food for increased understanding and knowledge. And we benefit from that experience. Everything's useful. Everything is can be beneficial if we learn how to use it. So that ability to develop and cultivate these qualities of mindfulness, as we're doing walking meditation, doing sitting meditation, we're sort of gaining a sense of confidence of okay, this is what works, this is what's helpful, and then gaining some skill in learning how to apply and sustain that mindfulness. Our cultivation, our training, is based on this, the foundation of developing mindfulness, and I think reflecting on what is right mindfulness, and as broadening one's perspective to include how the Buddha himself described and taught mindfulness. So we can take these reflections, instructions, and bring it in. And as we begin the retreat, I say, okay, how do we maintain and sustain a continuity of mindfulness?